Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Deidre Tyler. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Carol Emberton, the author of To Walk About in Freedom, The Long Emancipation of Priscilla Joyner. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Well, I'm a native of Kentucky, so I'm a native Southerner, although now I've lived outside of the South for longer than I ever lived there. But I've always, ever since childhood, been troubled, I guess you could say, really, by the history of race relations in the South. And so when I got to college and then later in graduate school, you know, I took that as an opportunity to, you know, to figure some of these things out that had been sort of troubling me and bothering me all of my life. And that led me into investigating the history of slavery and eventually the history of the Civil War and emancipation.
Why was the decision made to standardize the dialect used in the interviewing transcript?
Many of the people who were involved with sort of creating the Ex-Slave Narratives program, they were very much interested in how rural Black Southerners spoke, and trying to convey that to people who would be reading these interviews on paper rather than listening to them. And of course, as I talk about in the book, there's a long history of trying to convey or represent Black speech that had, you know, led to a history of, you know, sort of caricaturing the way Black Southerners sounded, particularly to white people and to white writers who were trying to convey that. So that, you know, if you read some of the old, you know, Uncle Remus tales or things like that, they come off as clownish, childish, backward. And that's the way a lot of people, particularly white Americans at the time, thought rural Black people spoke and how rural Black people were. So there was a sort of a tension within the Federal Writers Project from people who were sort of working out of that tradition, and others like Sterling Brown, who was a Harlem Renaissance poet who was also involved with the project, who wanted to capture sort of the creative quality of rural Black Southern speech, the idioms, turns of phrase, things like that, but was also very aware of how white people often read Black speech. And so he warned interviewers, you know, against that kind of, you know, caricaturing of Black speech that you often get when you read some of these transcripts.
So you decided for your book to standardize.
Yes. So when I am quoting from these interviews, a lot of times you do have, you know, the white people who conducted the interviews who will, you know, do things like the word was, W-A-S, but they will spell it W-U-Z. And they wrote in that dialect kind of writing. And Sterling Brown had issued, you know, very explicit instructions for these interviewers not to do that. And so when I went back through and I would encounter, you know, things that he had said don't do, I, you know, didn't do it because I, you know, I followed his instructions. That's how I, you know, I thought of it to myself. I want to follow what Sterling Brown's instructions were, because he was afraid it was going to cast the narrators themselves in a particularly bad light. And as someone who has taught these interviews before, and I teach them to my students all the time, it seems to put up a wall oftentimes between the person who is reading them and what the narrator is trying to say. And when that language is presented in that way, you know, a lot of times I've encountered students who just really can't get past it. So I didn't want the reader to be distracted or repelled by what they were reading. I really wanted them to get a sense and really think about what these people were saying and take it seriously.
Okay, let's look at Priscilla's life. Her mother was presumed to be Caucasian woman, and she was presumed to have a black father. Now, she was in the home of white people. How do you think this impacted her for 12 years?
I think it was very hard on her. And when you read her interview transcript, you can see that even though, you know, she's 80 something years old when she's giving this interview, she's still struggling with it. So the woman who raised her, Anna Liza Joyner, who was the woman who claimed to be her biological mother, you can see Priscilla struggling with that because of the experiences that she had growing up in that white home. As the story goes, the story that Anna Liza told Priscilla later on was that she and her husband, Anna Liza's husband, a man named Rix Joyner, had a falling out because Rix had sold the two enslaved people that Anna Liza's father had given to her when she and Rix got married. And he had sold them without her permission. So she kicks him out of the house. He's kind of a ne'er-do-well type person. And while he's gone away from the home for some period of time, she has an affair with a black man, and she will never say who it was. And she becomes pregnant, and Priscilla is born. And when Rix eventually returns to the home, of course, he finds this black baby and his wife claiming that it's hers. And, you know, he's sort of forced to live, you know, with this new circumstance. The story goes, according to Anna Liza, that she makes a deal with him, that he doesn't have to pay her back for those two enslaved people that he sold, if he will accept Priscilla as her daughter, and they'll all live in this and allow her to keep her, and they'll all live in the same household. So that's how the story goes. But Rix is obviously not happy about this, according to what Priscilla says. He treats her terribly. He teaches the other white children, presumably Priscilla's half-siblings, to torment her, to ostracize her. And, you know, that sets her up as sort of an outsider within this household that she's raised within. And Anna Liza, if she is indeed her biological mother, doesn't seem to be willing or able to do much about how her husband and how the other children treat Priscilla.
Why do you think Priscilla's mother sent her to live with a black family?
According to Priscilla, this happens when she's about 12 years old. So this is after the Civil War. It's after emancipation in North Carolina. And according to Priscilla, she's getting older. And she says something really interesting in the interview. She says there are two older daughters and there are two younger sons. And the younger half-brothers, Annalisa's white sons that she has with Rick, are getting old enough that they're starting to jump on her. And she doesn't really say what she means by that, other than they're starting to kind of physically assault her, it seems. And so Annalisa, I think, is worried about Priscilla's safety. And it's kind of becoming increasingly clear that even though Rix is no longer in the home, he's actually killed during the Civil War, that this is not the place for Priscilla, and that perhaps it's time for her to go, according to what Priscilla says, to be with her own people. So she sends her to live with a nearby black family, and to go to a freedman school with other black children, and to be, as Priscilla says, this is what is to be with her own people.
Now, tell us about the project of Professor Roscoe Lewis and Miss Thelma Dunstan. How were they limited on really telling the truth? And how did this book connect with that project?
Right. So Roscoe Lewis and Thelma Dunstan worked for the Virginia Writers Project, which was sort of the state level version of the Federal Writers Project. Each state had its own sort of state level organization of that. And Virginia had about 12, usually a dozen, sometimes around 10, the number kind of fluctuated, black interviewers. One of them was Thelma Dunstan, who were going around the state interviewing formerly enslaved people. And Roscoe Lewis was their supervisor. Now, he had been a chemistry professor at Hampton University. But like a lot of people during the Great Depression, he took the opportunity, you know, to take this job with the Virginia Writers Project. He was the supervisor of Dunstan and the other black field workers in Virginia. He did some of the interviews as well. And he was working on a book called The Negro in Virginia, which was going to be published using these interviews. And it was basically sort of writing the history of the state from the black perspective. The problem was, Roscoe Lewis's supervisor was a white woman named Eudora Ramsey Richardson. And she edited that text, the manuscript of The Negro in Virginia, with a very heavy hand. And she was not unlike a lot of white supervisors in these projects. She was very skeptical of the whole project of interviewing ex-slaves. She thought a lot of what they were telling were sort of like tall tales and stories that couldn't be believed, that were full of exaggeration. She thought particularly that Roscoe Lewis was sort of a gullible person who just believed anything these elderly people were telling him. She didn't think he was critical enough of the stories, and she was particularly disturbed by tales of abuse that these people had experienced when they were enslaved. And so she would try to edit those kinds of stories out of the manuscript that Lewis was producing for The Negro in Virginia. And in some cases, she would even go and re-interview people he had interviewed because she was she didn't believe, that she would read the transcript in the interview and think, oh, that couldn't have possibly happened. And she would go and try to re-interview people. So Lewis and Dunstan and the other black field workers who were conducting these interviews and trying to make them available for a wider audience they're limited in their ability to do that by supervisors like Richardson and by just the general, desire of white editors and the people who are in charge of these projects, not to paint the history of the state that they were working on, in this case, Virginia, in a negative light.
Now, what were some of the events in Mrs. Priscilla Joyner's life that examined the relationships between blacks and whites Which example would you like to give us?
Well, I think it's, you know, when she's 12 years old, she moves to a nearby town about 10 miles away from where she was born, that is next to Tarboro, North Carolina. And it was right next to Tarboro was a black settlement of ex-slaves called, at the time it was called Freedom Hill or Liberty Hill. It was later, a few decades later, incorporated as the town of Princeville, North Carolina, which still exists in Edgecombe County today. And it was there, living amongst this community of formerly enslaved people, that, you know, Priscilla, I think, you know, really began to feel a part of what it was like to be part of a community and to have her people. It's where she met her husband, the man that would become her husband. And, you know, the settlement of Freedom Hill really had, you know, an interesting story. It was on land that had been owned by this man, this slave owner called L.L. Dancy. And in the years, you know, say the 10 years or so, you know, after the Civil War, even though these former slaves of Dancy's are now free, I found in the records of the State Archives of North Carolina all of these instances where he's trying to apprentice black children against their parents' or their guardian's will. And he's trying to maintain his control over the people that he once owned that he no longer does. But what you see there is really sort of a thriving community come into being. And, you know, it becomes, you know, this town, it becomes one of the first all black towns in the United States. And I actually think, you know, Princeville claims to be sort of the longest standing black town in the United States. And it's still there today. So the story, you know, Priscilla's personal story also sort of dovetails with the story of this community there in Princeville in Edgecombe County. And it's really a wonderful, beautiful story.
Now, in the book, you said she was a member of the character generation. Can you explain what are you meaning by character generation?
Yeah. I call these people who were interviewed by the Federal Writers Project, these former slaves who were being interviewed in the 1930s. They're all very elderly people by that time. But I refer to them as the charter generation of freedom because they are the people who were born into slavery. But who experienced the Civil War and emancipation firsthand. They're eyewitnesses to these events, and they live through these tumultuous decades. And they have these amazing emancipation stories that are available in the transcripts of these interviews that really give us a ground level, personal, intimate view into what it was like to live through that transition and to think about what it was going to mean to be free and what kind of lives, you know, what kind of things were possible. And I think a lot of times, you know, when we think about the Civil War and the Reconstruction years, we think a lot about the right to vote, you know, and civil rights. And those are really important stories to be told. But what you don't get a lot of when you read the historical literature are these kinds of intimate, very personal stories about people who were sort of deciding, you know, where should I live? Where should I go? What could I possibly do with my life now that I couldn't do before? You know, who's going to love me? Who am I going to get married to? Do I want to get married? And these are really personal kinds of struggles and decisions that they have to make that you don't often read when you read about the political and the cultural upheavals of this time. So that's what I was wanting to really bring to light in this book. And those are all available, and I found them when I was reading these interviews.
Okay, tell us about the discipline imagination and how you use that in telling Mrs. Priscilla Joyner's story.
You know, I say in the book that this is really not a biography of Priscilla Joyner because there are so many gaps in what I know about her. And that is true for most people who were formerly enslaved. If you're writing about enslaved people or people who were formerly enslaved, you know, you face this problem as a historian that there are a lot of gaps, right, that you can't always fill in. You might find a document here or a piece of evidence there, and you have to fill in a lot of these gaps to the best that you can. And so historians, those of us who work in these sort of fragmented archives and who really want to try to understand the lives of enslaved and formerly enslaved people and to take them seriously, you have to kind of use a disciplined imagination to think about, you know, what people might have been thinking or feeling or going through at a particular moment in time when you may not necessarily have a document or any kind of documentary evidence that tells you exactly what was going on. Now, there's a school of historical thought, excuse me, or study that says, well, if you don't have a document, if you don't have, you know, hard evidence, then you can't say, and we don't know, and you just can't go there. The problem with that view is that you would then these people like Priscilla Joyner and the Charter Generation of Freedom and enslaved people, you'd never be able to write about them with any kind of depth or any kind of detail, because there is so much we don't know. So it's important to, you know, you read deeply, you find everything you can, but then you have to rely on, you know, your own sort of sense of, you know, human interaction and human desire and understanding to think about how the world, how, you know, people like Priscilla Joyner, you know, encountered the world at that point in time.
Now, you talk about the census enumerator. How did they go about describing people's racial identifications?
So that changed over time. In the mid-19th century, the 1850s and the 1860s, 1860 is when Priscilla, she's born in 1858, so the first time she appears in a census is the 1860 census. And at that time, the racial categories that were available were white, for a white person, black, B, for a black person, and M, mulatto, for a person that appeared to be mixed race or of a lighter skin tone than a black person. So obviously at the time, a lot of that depends on sort of a visual interpretation of whoever the enumerator is, right? And someone, you know, might look at a person and say, oh, they look dark skinned to me, so I'll put black. But another enumerator might see a person with a similar skin tone and say, oh, that's a light-skinned person, and they would put M. And so it's all very subjective, right? And of course, it's going on the notion at the time that you could look at somebody and tell what race they are. But of course, we know things, you know, genetics are much more complicated than that. And there were people who were so light-skinned that they could pass for white, or you could look at them and think that they were quote-unquote white. And so it was very, very complicated. But the way the census was organized at that time just reflected the general idea that you could look at someone and easily tell what race they were.
Mrs. Joyner made a trip to see her mother every year, but there was one year that she didn't make that trip to see her biological mother. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is when she's living in Edgecombe County, and she's going to school the years from she's about 12 to 16, 17 years old. And she says every year she would go home for Christmas to visit Aunt Eliza and the other members of that household, of her that family. But I think it's about when she's 16, she doesn't go home that year because she's met a fellow. And it's a man named Lewis Joyner. They have the same last name because he is actually had been enslaved by another member of the sort of extended Joyner family. The Joyners, there are many, 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 many Joyners in sort of Nash and Edgecombe County, North Carolina at that time. They're all, many of them, I'd say the vast majority of them are related either by marriage or by blood. And so Lewis Joyner had been enslaved by one of the many white Joyners in the area. So she had met Lewis. He's older than she is by about 4 or 5 years. And they've fallen in love. And he asked her that year, you know, don't go home, don't leave, stay here with me for Christmas. And so that's what she does that year.
Now, free people rush to marry. What were some of the advantages that they gain?
Yeah, many formerly enslaved people, when they are able to legally marry after emancipation, they do so. They want to legalize long-standing relationships. Many of them have been in, you know, non-recognized marriages for many, many years, and they wanted the legal protections that went with being in a legally sanctioned marriage. So they would go to the Justice of the Peace or whoever and get that long-standing relationship sort of recognized by the state. And this was also the first opportunity that many of them had to sort of openly sort of say, you know, I choose to marry this person and I choose to commit, you know, and make this commitment to them. Because when they had been enslaved, of course, they couldn't do that. Many of them had long-standing relationships, but those were always dependent upon sort of the will of whoever the white slave owner was to allow those relationships to be in the first place or to continue. The old saying for enslaved people had been that their wedding vows were until love or sale do you part, right? Because a slave owner could at any point in time decide to break up a family, and, you know, sell the husband, sell the wife in separate places. And that was it. And they had no control over that. But once slavery is over and once they have the opportunity to legally marry and to be recognized by the state as legally married, that was no longer going to happen, right? So this was about taking control of their own personal lives, getting, you know, the kind of recognition from the state that we all recognize, you know, the kind of legal benefits that we recognize as going to married couples, people who are legally married. Their children are now, quote unquote, legitimate, right? And they're theirs and they can't be taken away from them. People who still weren't married, single mothers, at the time, even after slavery is over, their children are still vulnerable because the state can come in and apprentice the children of a single mother at the time if the state feels that she can't provide for them. But being married, if she were married and in a legally recognized marriage, that wouldn't happen to her. So there are real, you know, legal benefits to being married and to having those relationships legalized.
Priscilla and Lewis started their life in Stony Creek. Lewis had a half white brother. Tell us the relationship and why he ended up moving his family.
So Stony Creek, this is a sort of the neighborhood. It's a rural neighborhood, not far from not far from Freedom Hill or Rocky Mount, or the place was where Lewis and Priscilla were born and grew up. So it's all in that general, location. They move, and, you know, after their marriage, they set up a house, and Lewis is sharecropping. He is working for a man called Reuben Joyner, who is most likely his older half-brother, White. Reuben is White. So Reuben owns the land. Lewis is renting or working for shares on the land. And they're there probably for about 10 years. And so this is actually a part of the book where I sort of, you know, use a disciplined imagination to imagine what it was like for Lewis to be working for the man who was most likely his older brother. We don't exactly know what Priscilla is doing at the time, but if she is like other sharecroppers' wives at the time, she's most likely cooking and taking in laundry to earn extra money. So she is probably doing Reuben and his family's wash, right? So Lewis is not only working for his half-brother, his wife is probably washing his half-brother's, you know, and his half-brother's family's dirty laundry. And they're also living at the time when, in the late 1870s and the 1880s, lynching is starting to become, a real problem in the South. And there's a lynching that happens during this period, not far from where Lewis and Priscilla are living. They're having children. I imagine, you know, it's not hard to imagine that they're worrying about their little sons growing up and being at risk of being accused of, as many lynching victims were, unjustifiably, of raping or having relations with a white woman. And so, you know, I put together, you know, everything I know, not just about what's happening to Lewis and Priscilla, because, again, the documentation is very sparse, but about, you know, what it was like for Black people to be living, you know, in the Jim Crow South and sharecropping and living with sort of the terrorism, the white terrorism and vigilantism of lynching at the time. And so I'm building up that world that Priscilla and Lewis inhabited from a variety of different sources.
Now, after they made the move, they had children to get sick. That told us so much about tuberculosis. Can you give us some details on how the community saw tuberculosis in among Blacks?
So tuberculosis was a leading, and it at some points during the turn of the century and from the 19th to the 20th century was the leading killer among particularly Black people who were living in urban areas. And by this time, Lewis and Priscilla had moved to Suffolk, Virginia, which was about 100 miles away. It was a smaller city, but still definitely a more urban area than where they had been living at Stony Creek in Nash County, North Carolina. And like lots of other urban and semi-urban places, Suffolk had a real problem with tuberculosis among the city's African-American residents, in large part because they're living in more crowded conditions. They're often living in less sanitary conditions, and it's the conditions in which tuberculosis spreads very easily. So Priscilla and Lewis in the first two decades of the 20th century lose three daughters, a son, and a granddaughter, a tiny granddaughter, to tuberculosis. And this, again, we have to try to imagine what kind of effect did this have on Lewis and Priscilla, you know, and all of these children die in their home while Priscilla is trying to nurse them and take care of them. And, you know, there's their access to medical care is very limited. There are at the time no black doctors in Suffolk, so they have to rely on white physicians who often look upon black victims of tuberculosis as unclean, as contagious. They treat them with anything but the kind of dignity that they deserve. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, the pain that this caused Priscilla to try to care for her children, to know that there's very little she can do for them. They don't have the money to send them to a fancy, you know, tuberculosis sanatoriums that were popular with wealthier people who had tuberculosis at the time, where you could go and try to recuperate and, you know, get healthy food and clean air and all those kinds of things. So there was really nothing for them to do but sort of sit and watch their children die. And it's the kind of legacy of, you know, racism and lack of access to healthcare that continues to this day, unfortunately, for African Americans.
Now, on a brighter note, how important was flowers in Mrs. Jerner's life?
Yeah, Priscilla earned her money once they moved to Suffolk. She was known as a fabulous gardener. And when Thelma Dunstan and Roscoe Lewis first arrive at her house to interview her, she shows them around her magnificent flower gardens and tells them how, you know, at Easter and the holidays, Mother's Day, things like that, all the white ladies in town, you know, come to her for their table settings, their centerpieces, and their corsages, because she is known as such a wonderful gardener. And this is probably something she learned way back as a teenage girl when she was living, you know, near the people of Freedom Hill. Once Freedom Hill is incorporated as Princeville, Princeville becomes known as the town or the city of flowers. They were known for their beautiful gardens. The houses were very modest. They weren't much to look at. They weren't very fancy. But they were known for having these magnificent, beautiful flower gardens. So I suspect this is something Priscilla learned there. You know, and I think I'm a gardener. I love to grow flowers. And I think anyone who gardens will tell you, you know, it can be really therapeutic to work in the garden and to create, you know, a sense of beauty and, you know, sort of coax that life out of the earth. And I think that, you know, I think that was probably true for Priscilla as well. Even when she's enduring some of these tragic losses, like the loss of her children to disease, you know, she is able to grow these beautiful flowers and people appreciate her for that.
Now, you use the term refugee in the book. Can you explain a little bit more about the use of the term refugee?
Sure. And when I'm using the term refugee, I'm talking about, you know, people during the Civil War who become, they're in the process of becoming free. So they've been enslaved, but the war is making its way to wherever they're living, their farm, their plantation. And a lot of times you see these people becoming, you know, they're refugees. They have to take to the road. They're leaving, you know, where they were, either because war has made those places inhospitable to live. They're trying to get away from the danger. They're trying to find someplace else to go, someplace better, someplace safer. And so what you see during the Civil War and during Reconstruction in the decade, you know, in the years after the Civil War, it doesn't stop when the war is over by any means, is you see a lot of movement throughout and around the South by, you know, for formerly enslaved people. They're moving around. They're going, a lot of times they're maybe not going that far, but they're, you know, moving to different locations. They're trying different things out. And in many of those cases, it's because they're being refugeed, either from the war or during Reconstruction by white violence and vigilantism, like the Ku Klux Klan. They're being run off their land, run out of their homes. And so you know, other historians like Amy Taylor, who wrote a book about Black refugees during the Civil War, really talks about how the war, and I would also argue Reconstruction, created a kind of refugee crisis similar to the ones we've been witnessing in our own time with the wars in Syria and now, unfortunately, in Ukraine. You know, America has had those too a long time ago, but we don't often look at the Civil War or Reconstruction as creating those kind of refugee crises.
What message do you want to leave the audience with once they finish reading your book?
I really want them to get a sense that emancipation, the process of becoming free and learning to think of oneself as free, was an intensely personal journey, right? You know, when the Civil War was over, they estimate that approximately 4.5 million people were enslaved and became free. But that process was not sort of an instantaneous or, you know, sort of a single moment. Like, you know, and that's how we often think about it, I think. You know, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, or the war was over, slavery was over, and they were free. But it really didn't happen like that. This was an extended process that took years. And in some cases, what you see with the charter generation in these interviews that I use in the book, it takes a lifetime for that sense of autonomy, that sense of freedom, that sense of sort of being liberated from the trauma of the past to manifest itself in any kind of, you know, really sort of tangible way. And I often tell my students, if there were 4.5 million enslaved people in the United States at the time of the Civil War, then there were 4.5 million emancipations, right? There wasn't a single emancipation. There were 4.5 million emancipations. Each one of them was individual. Each one of them was different. And each one of them meant something different to the person that experienced it. And I think that's the power of Priscilla Joyner's story. I think the power of these emancipation stories that are in the Federal Writers Project. And I just encourage anyone who finds these fascinating, you know, to go online to the Library of Congress, Google Born in Slavery, Library of Congress, and you can actually find these digitized online and you can begin reading them yourself. And I think it'll just open up a whole new world for you.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time today. What's your next project? What are you working on next?
Well, I think I am moving a little bit into the 20th century. As I sort of said at the beginning of the show, I'm from Kentucky. I'm from a small town called Russellville, which is right on the central Kentucky, right on the Kentucky-Tennessee border, not far from Nashville, Tennessee, really. And in 1908, there was a terrible mass lynching of 4 men. In my hometown of Russellville, Kentucky. And recently, some residents of the town, African-American residents, have been trying to get a memorial and really trying to get the town to reckon with this history of this lynching and the legacy of this lynching. And I will say, you know, part of why I'm drawn to this project is because I didn't know that it had happened until I was in college and read about it in a book, right? It was not a part of my sort of upbringing as a white person in this town, but obviously that wasn't the case for the Black residents of my town. And so I'm going to be digging into this, you know, this part of my own personal history and try to uncover not only what happened in 1908, why these men were lynched, what the sort of political and economic and cultural world was like that in this part of Kentucky at the time. But I also want to answer the question, you know, how was it possible to sort of, you know, for the white residents of this town to push this this history sort of underground, and how have the African-American residents of the town kept that memory alive, and what are they doing today to bring that story to light?
Well, that sounds like a great project. We'll be looking forward to it. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.